right. Well, actually, Andy, I pulled a little fast one on you all, and here's the reason why. I'm giving you a paper called Integrative Ministry. Originally, when we laid out the three papers, three talks at each of the three consultations, this was the last week. And what I was supposed to talk to you about was movement mindset. However, I've changed, and here's the reason why. As much as I would love to think that all of you are making all three of the consultations where I'm speaking, the reality, of course, is that a lot of you couldn't do that. And therefore, movement mindset is actually more on how people in the city can work together to reach a city. And I thought that I would, rather than have two of our three talks today be oriented toward how to reach a city, I thought I would move one of those talks to next time, because there might be some people who come to the next one who didn't come to the others. And it just, I wanted to move to integrative ministry, which had more to do with how the ministry is done inside the church. And so I have switched them around, and Hank knows about it and told me it was all right, that he absolved me. I had to do absolution. He had to do absolution. But I think you'll find that this would be a little bit of a departure from the other two, whereas the movement mindset would have been it would have been a supplement to what I just said about city, which is fine, but I'd rather next time I'm coming here to talk about movement mindset, because then it will take us away from theology into the city one more time. I just wanted a balanced diet every time we got together. Integrative ministry means I would like us to see that urban churches should all engage in four kinds of ministries in an integrative balance. And the ministries are what I'm calling evangelism, community formation, that is discipleship, which comes through forming deep Christian fellowship and community. Okay, evangelism, discipleship and community, ministries of justice and mercy in the city, and helping people integrate their faith in their work and therefore engage the culture. So, evangelism, community formation, justice and mercy, cultural renewal, or faith work integration. Those are the four. Now, there's a lot of churches that are big evangelism church growth churches. There are a lot of churches that are big on fellowship and community and living together in community. There are a lot of churches that are big on justice and mercy and caring for the poor. And there are churches that are big on the arts and, cultural stuff. But virtually no church pulls them together. In fact, you know what? The origin of this paper was one time that John Nichols was with us in, this is many years ago. Where are you, John? Yeah. Many, many years ago. And it was in New York, if I remember correctly. And you actually, in the earlier days of Redeemer, and you actually began, you noticed that to me. And he says, you know, I know of small group churches, I know of evangelism churches, I know of Labrie kinds of faith and work culture churches, I know of justice and mercy kinds of churches, but I've never seen a church that perhaps integrated them as well as you're trying to do. And I began to say, that's right, that is right. That's one of the things that is unusual, I think, about what the ministry we were doing, and that has been so fruitful. Now, first let me tell you about the balance. It's on this first page. It's true that evangelist types, faith culture types, and I'm talking about leaders, justice mercy types, community types don't like each other. If you get them in the same church, they don't like each other. They chafe each other. The people who want to work with the poor are feel like, why are you hobnobbing with those elite people and talking about art? And the people who want evangelism feel like all that money that you're pouring into the neighborhood, that could be going for missionary work, and people have souls that they're lost. And there's inside, how do I say, the specialists, the people who have great burdens for these ministries, actually chafe against one another. But if you're the pastor and you're looking at all of them, you see how they just integrate and they help each other, they stimulate each other. I often find if I can just keep the leaders of each of these ministries from killing each other, we're going to have a great church. Because if you look at these bullet points down here near the bottom, evangelism is supported by what I'm calling here holistic ministry, ministry to the needy. And why? First, some people, as you are helping them, find their way into the church and come to faith. But on top of that, the whole city is more likely to listen to you preaching the word of God and telling them to get converted if they see you being a compassionate ministry. I once heard a non-Christian say about a local church, like, here's what he said. I don't know that I'll ever believe what they believe. In fact, a lot of their beliefs are offensive, but if they left the community, we'd have to raise taxes. They're pressing so much value into the community. I don't know what we do without them. Now, you know, some people say, oh, that's not a good use of resources. Obviously, if they're doing that, that means that money could be going to evangelism. But I'll tell you, here's a man who is open to evangelism from this church, just by the way in which he spoke. He said, I'm not sure. In fact, some of the things are offensive, but. Now, here's a man who is going to give you the time of day if you're the preacher, if you're the minister of that church, even though here's a person who clearly doesn't have much sympathy at all with Christianity. But that person's going to listen to you. They will. So evangelism is not only supported by holistic ministry, but then on the other hand, holistic ministry is dependent on evangelism. Why? Evangelism creates vital new lives in Christ that are necessary if the church is serving others. One of the great ironies, I mentioned this already, some of you laughed, you should. You have these churches, these mainline churches, at least in New York City, that are all for the poor, but they have 20 old people in them because they don't know how to convert people. And so they're not creating the kind of new life in Christ believers who are filled with energy, who care about the people around them. The irony of the mainline churches is they don't produce converted people to do the help. And then let me give you another one, third bullet point. Christian community and evangelism are symbiotically related. What I mean by that is, on the one hand, converted individuals form deep Christian fellowship, but it's also true that strong, loving fellowship attracts people. Now, in the early days of the church, I constantly, when we had a kind of revival, I think I mentioned this to you in November, we saw a lot of people become Christians. And I spent a lot of my time with non-Christians. And at one point, I not only got criticism, but I had a couple people leave the church angry because I wasn't working hard enough on building close Christian community. I was always spending all my time with non-believers. And the joke around Redeemer was, because I'm an evangelistic type, I tended to privilege non-Christians. I'd see them. And then, of course, I spent time with my leaders. But the joke was, if you actually become a Christian for the 10 years until you become a leader, you'll never see Tim. You know, so you need to feign unbelief if you want to ever get any counsel from him. And I got some of those jokes were bitter jokes. Actually, they weren't really. And they were saying, you spend all your time outside and you're not working enough on the church is growing so fast, and you're not working hard enough on community. And I think, by and large, those kinds of criticisms stuck. And I actually found that there did seem to be a need for me to put my emphasis on outreach until I started to realize that our community was suffering, and then put a lot of emphasis on community and discipleship until I began to see that people were turning inward. It's almost like a sideways figure eight. It's like you put all your emphasis on one until you realize pretty soon somebody's going to start complaining that we're not looking outward enough. And so you always want to get ahead of the curve, and you want to start to make the changes. You want to be the leader who says, I don't think we're doing enough outreach now. And then everybody says, that's right. And then you lead them into – it's almost impossible to do these things identically well, equally well at the same time. And yet I'm here to tell you that you mustn't choose one over the other, because they're symbiotically related. It's attractive community. That's one of the reasons why non-believers are open to the gospel. They see us loving each other. But on the other hand, frankly, there's nothing better for Christian community than a constant stream of new believers coming in. excited about the gospel. You see their lives changed, and it's just galvanizing to Christian community. Now, I'm just trying to say these things have to go together. One other thing, of course, is, well, never mind. I won't. Let's just delve down into them. The two important introductory notes, and I'm going to watch this on page two. There's two things to say before I go into talking about the four. One is, please keep something in mind that I mentioned in November, and if you weren't here, I better say it again. Definitely. I am a believer in what Abraham Kuyper called the distinction between the institutional church and the organic church. Now, these are, he's getting at something biblical, even though I'm not wedded to these terms, and they're a little clunky. And besides that, he must have said this in Dutch, so I don't know who translated them. But what he meant by the institutional church was the local church under its officers and united together to preach the word, do baptism in the Lord's Supper, administer discipline. What he meant by the organic church was Christians banding together to form agencies, Christian organizations, voluntary associations to address all kinds of things, everything from poverty in the neighborhood to academic renewal to an art gallery, all sorts of things that we in the States would call all kinds of nonprofit organizations. And what he would say is that the institutional church's main job is evangelism and discipleship. But the institutional church has to disciple individuals to band together into the organic church and to get out there and do justice and mercy and do cultural renewal. But there's a spot at which we have to be it's not a bright line, but there's a line that should be drawn. So, for example, I should train my people in my church who are artists and filmmakers how to think their faith, how their faith has an impact on their work. But my church shouldn't start a film company. Okay? The Christians ought to start the film company. And that's the difference, Kuyper says, between the institutional church and the organic church. And therefore, when I say that the church has to do evangelism and community and discipleship and faith work integration and justice and mercy, I'm still recognizing that it's not a complete balance here. My local church will do mercy and justice in an immediate neighborhood to some degree, but there's a whole lot of work that has to be done in the city that would best be done by Christians banding together into agencies and trusts and charities in order to do that work, rather than have the officers of a local church try to oversee a film company or oversee a drug rehabilitation center. And that's very important to keep in mind. And yet you might say, well, then you're not saying that you're all for a balance. Well, yes, look. At the executive level, and I'm a big church, so we have a number of staff people. But I have a woman who's over our Faith and Work, Center for Faith and Work. I have two women who are over our diaconate and who are over our what we call Hope for New York, which is a 501c3, which is to say it's actually a separate organization in close connection to Redeemer, spun out of Redeemer, but actually doing all kinds of work amongst the poor and yet as a separate foundation. And we have community, which is small groups, and we have evangelism, and all these folks meet together every week at the most top level in the church with me and my sort of director of staff. And that's our way of trying to say to everybody, these ministries are all interdependent and equally important. We don't have this hierarchy. And we want you to work together. We want you to love each other. And we also want you to be to see all the synergy between the different ministries. And we want you to appreciate and be passionate for each other's ministries. And it's working very, very well. Now, having said that, I also don't believe that any church is going to actually be equally good at all four of those. Part of it's the pastor at the top. You've got certain gifts. Part of it is your situation. If you are actually in a really poor area, or you're actually in a very rich area, and urban churches have to be both places, it's just natural that there's going to be some difference as to, emphasis. So when I say these four things need to be kept in balance as much as possible and in an interactive, symbiotic relationship, I also recognize people have different gifts. There are different contexts and situations. And so some will usually be stronger than the others. All I want you to do is not to give up on any of them. Not to say, because I'm passionate about evangelism and I find this a little bit weird over here, therefore we just don't do that. We do this over here. As a church, you need as much as you possibly can to work on all of them and to try to keep them interrelated as much as you possibly can. Having said that, let me just go down into two or three, because this session, let's see, I forgot to look. Yeah, when I'm looking up at the clock, help me. This session goes till what? Oh, yeah, okay, here we go. All right, okay. Okay, I'll tell you what I would like to do. First of all, when I'm trying to show you integration, let me show you how I believe your Sunday gathering. Some of you may call it a worship service, some of you may not, but your Sunday gathering ought to be evangelistic. Here, I'm going to show you the integration. So turn over to page 3, okay? No, better yet, turn over to page 4. No, turn to page 5. Forgive me. There's a premise behind an awful lot of ministry that you can't edify believers and evangelize non-believers at the same time. And you certainly can't do it in your Sunday gatherings. I would like, as my first step in talking about integrative ministry, to argue the contrary. I'd like to say that it is very, very possible to preach the gospel and to conduct your services in such a way that both believers in general are edified and non-believers in general are evangelized. Let me very quickly say, if you're expounding the text true to the text, you will find that some texts actually are more oriented toward non-believers. There are actually more calls to repentance. And you'll find that some texts really are more oriented toward believers to edify, build them up, sanctify them, change them. But I'm here to tell you, you can always preach and build your service around a particular message, regardless of, even if it's privileging non-Christians or privileging Christians in the audience, that the other side never feels left out. There's a way to lead, to actually speak to non-believers and call them to repentance in a way that believers feel edified and are learning and are growing, and vice versa. And let me give you what I would consider the biblical reasons for it. If you go to 1 Corinthians 14, and if you just read what Paul Barnett actually says in his commentary, I think it's it's a commentary on 1 Corinthians. And if you go to almost any commentary on 1 Corinthians, there's an interesting place in 1 Corinthians 14 where Paul is saying that if a non-believer or an inquirer comes in and sees you prophesying, and in their language, in their vernacular, will they not be cut to the quick, convicted, the secrets of their heart will be revealed, and they'll fall down and they'll say, God is really here. And no matter how you slice it, I think the way Paul Barnett actually puts it is, despite all efforts to devise programs for evangelism and outreach, the gathered congregation, and this is actually on page 4, I'm sorry to be jumping around, this is, I think, a pretty powerful statement. And Paul Barnett's a, you know, conservative evangelical Anglican Australian bishop. Despite all efforts to devise programs for evangelism and outreach, the gathered congregation in its life of ministry remain a potent force for gathering in the outsider. Churches and their ministers, however, must ensure that the Word of God is intelligible and powerfully taught so that the visitor will indeed say, God is with you. I think he's right. Now, he's interpreting prophecy as a form of preaching, and I do too, and maybe that's worth, you know, that might be debatable, but nevertheless, I think he's basically right. And therefore, going back to page 5, I think when I survey 1 Corinthians 14, and I survey other things in the Bible, I come to these three conclusions. One, non-believers are expected to be present in Christian worship. Paul expects them to be there. Number two, non-believers must find the praise of Christians to be comprehensible. Whatever we do there, we ought to be doing it in a way that fits in, not just with their actual language. It's not just that you have to be doing it in a language that they can barely understand, but they what does it mean to worship in the vernacular? What does it mean to preach in the vernacular? It means the secrets of their heart are revealed because what you're saying connects with their hearts and they understand it. And it's convicting to non-Christians in the gathered service. And then number three, non-believers then can fall under conviction and be converted through comprehensible worship. Now, how do we do that? Let me take you through just the headings. Three practical tasks for if you want to have a worship service, which is on the one hand, edifying people, right? Gathering people, creating disciples, but at the same time, reaching non-Christians. How do you integrate them like that? Here. Point two. Now, you think that was a typographical error, don't you? Ha-ha. It's not. It's actually trying to make a point. Everybody worries about how are we going to get non-Christians into the service. If we're going to evangelize non-Christians in the service, how do we get them in? Well, we have to give people little cards. And the cards say, invite your Christian friend to this. Now, by the way, if you just did this last week, I'm sorry, I'm making you feel bad. I'm trying to say I don't believe that you need a technique to get Christians to invite non-Christians to worship or to your services. If your services are already in the condition I'm about to delineate. A Christian layperson comes to your service, listens to you preach, listens to the music. There's a lot of Christians who walk in and they say, oh, I like this. But they intuitively know that their non-Christian friends would not. They would hate it, or they would be confused or even offended by it. They wouldn't even think of bringing their non-Christian friend to it. But if a lay person, if a Christian comes into your service the very first time and sits down, and at the end of the time says, my non-Christian sister or my non-Christian friend, or boy, I would like them to be here. This is getting across everything I try to get across to them, but I'm afraid to, or I'm not articulate enough to do. See, if you have believers in your services saying, if only I could bring my non-Christian friend to be here, this is what I wanted, they're going to be there. That's the reason why I guess I go so far as to say, if you create a service and if you preach in such a way that non-Christians are present, even if they aren't present, they will soon be present because they will be brought. Why will they be brought? Because Christians actually desperately want to find a place where they can bring their friends if they could. And we're not giving it to them. Now you say, well, how do you create a place like that? Well, okay, let me show you at the bottom of page 5. All right? Let's start. The first part is worship and preaching in the vernacular. I already talked about that, but what does that mean? Well, turn over to 6. I have a set of bullet points. Here is a... You, at the end of the very first paragraph, do you see this underlined sentence? One of the things that you just have to do is listen to everything said in the service with the ears of somebody who has doubts or troubles with belief. And just, in other words, try to put yourself in their place. And you're going to have a long list of things. You know, one of the problems that Kathy, my wife, has when we go on vacation someplace and we visit churches is everything... Now, she has those ears. She's got better ears than I do. She listens to everything said in a service, everything said in a sermon immediately with the ears of people who have doubts and troubles with belief, and she makes long lists on her program, and then she gives them to the preacher afterwards, even if she's married to him. No, I should actually say especially if she's married to him. But here are the things that she would probably say, by the way. Here are some bullet points from my wife's programs over the years. Take great pains to explain theological terms in ways that are readily understandable to those without theological background. Especially avoid citing the Bible or making explanations with a tone. This is always unspoken, but the tone. Well, everybody intelligent knows this. Watch how you cite authorities. Be very careful that when you cite authorities, that these would be authorities. You see, you can cite authorities in a way that the person out there who's never heard of the authority feels stupid. For example, if you just say, if you cite a biblical passage and then say, and therefore Christians believe this, and then suddenly say, look, I know for a lot of you That sounds outrageous, but would you please consider this? See, that shows that you know that they're there. And that shows that you don't think they're idiots for being offended by what you just said. But if you just say, this is what Christians believe, and you know it's offensive to people outside of Christianity, and you don't say anything about it, then those people feel not only invisible, like, oh, so you must think I'm an idiot, because I can't believe you said that. And as soon as you show them that you know that's how they're feeling, but you've thought about it yourself, and you speak to them in a just kindly tone, they immediately feel included. Do you do that? Of course you don't. You know why? It's a vicious circle. Here's the circle. You know that those people aren't there. And because you know they're not there, you don't act as if they're there. You don't talk like they're there. And because you don't talk like they're there, nobody brings them. You see that, what's going on here? All right. So let me continue down my wife's checklist. Never talk as if non-believing people are not present. I'm sorry, I forgot that. We always expect to be overheard by members of the non-believing press. By the way, Kathy always says, don't say things that you don't want to show up on the... But if you're going to say something, say it in a way that you know might show up on the front page of the New York Times tomorrow. And what that doesn't mean, I don't say anything that won't offend people, but I say things in a way. I gave you an example with abortion. What do? I make sure I float the B doctrine on the A doctrine, so if a person doesn't like it, they know that I have actually been making an effort to reach out to them. Number three, avoid tribal languages, unnecessarily stylized evangelical pious jargon, and archaic language that seeks to set a spiritual tone. Avoid we-them language, disdainful jokes that mock people of different politics and belief, or dismissive, disrespectful comments about those who differ with us. Constantly anticipate and address the concerns, objections, and reservations of the skeptical or of spiritual pilgrims with the greatest respect and sympathy. And then avoid sentimental, this is right for my wife, by the way, avoid sentimental, pompous, emotionally manipulative, inspirational talk. Instead, engage the culture with gentle, self-deprecating, but joyful irony that the gospel creates. Joyful irony simply means, you know, you don't take yourself so seriously because the gospel has deflated your pride. But at the same time, you're happy. See, there's a kind of irony that's clearly unhappy. And so that's sarcastic, and there's a bitterness to it. There's a kind of irony that comes from just not taking yourself too seriously because the gospel has taken your pride away. But at the same time, the gospel has given you a tremendous joy. And that brings about a kind of gentle, self-deprecating, joyful irony that is very... It's not pompous, it's not sentimental, and actually, it's actually very attractive to non-believers. They see it. It's not the pomposity they expect in legalist and moralist, which they hear, but it's not the bitterness and the sarcasm and the fear of saying anything inspirational that they see in secular people. It's really different. Okay, so that's preaching in the vernacular, as it were. I mean, worshiping in the vernacular. Number B, explain the service as you go along, which means let people know. There's a danger of verbosity here. There is a tendency for evangelical services to be nothing but talk, 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 talk. No silence, no prayer, no singing, just talk, talk, talk. Nevertheless, it's important to explain what's happening. So people know what's happening, so that you just don't expect a newcomer to just pick it up. Three, directly address and welcome them, and I already gave you an example of that. Regularly say, now, to those of you who aren't sure you believe this or aren't sure what you believe, I would suggest this. You just address them. You act like they're there. Articulate their objections to Christian living and belief better than they could do themselves. That is so important. They cannot hear their position caricatured. You know, set up like a straw man and then knocked down. They've got to hear their own concerns expressed by you or by the whoever's up front talking about things with sympathy, but then saying, but no, this is what the Bible says. But the objection has to show sympathy and understanding. Now, D, this is a controversy, I suppose, but when I say highly skilled art, I want you to, don't look down there, look at me for a second. In general, I want you to know, it all depends on where you are, but in general, the music, even the speaking, even the reading of the scripture, but certainly the music, the art that you do in the service really ought to be as high a level of quality and excellence as you can muster. And the reason why it's important, I know a lot of evangelicals almost deliberately disdain artistic excellence. It's almost a way of saying all that really matters is the word, and we're not into all this worldly stuff. But let me use an illustration. Okay, if you are in a nice little church and one of the matrons, one of the pillars of the church is Mrs. McGillicuddy, and Mrs. McGillicuddy has an 8-year-old niece that we all love. Her name is Agnes, and we all love Agnes. And Agnes today is going to play the piano for us during the offering. And Agnes is 12, okay? So Agnes plays the piano, and it is terrible. It is utterly terrible. However, everybody who knows Agnes and everybody who knows Mrs. McGillicuddy is touched. They remember her. They remember her when they took care of her in the creche. They remember her when they taught her Sunday school and that sort of thing. And therefore, because they have a relationship with her, they're edified by the horrible music. But if a person comes from outside and doesn't know Agnes, doesn't know Mrs. McGillicuddy, never had Agnes in Sunday school, it's just an awful 4 minutes. And that person is completely excluded. Do you understand what's going on? Excellence in music is more inclusive. Because if there's a very touching and lovely rendition of a particular piece of music, with or without words, everybody is sort of moved by it. And there's reasons why. But there's good theological and biblical reasons why we ought to take music pretty seriously. But in other words, bad music is great for the insiders because it always is usually done by somebody who's got a relationship with everybody else out there. And good music is much more inclusive of outsiders as well as insiders. And if you really want your services or your times to be as inclusive as possible and have as broad an appeal, you'll do everything you possibly can to make sure that people who are producing the music are producing really, really jaw-droppingly good music. Then, E, celebrate deeds of mercy and justice. You've got this thing called the offering. And traditionally, in worship services, the offering was a time to talk about giving to the community, talk about what we're doing in the community. There is a place in which occasionally you can talk about what God is doing in the community or what they're doing through our diaconate. Like, for example, every so often we'll have an offering for our diaconate. The diaconate offering, the diaconate works with people inside the church or immediately around the church that have economic problems. They give money, they care for people, they give counseling and so forth. And there's no better time to have a testimony from, because we're very careful about privacy, even Americans, some Americans still, even after Oprah, some of us still believe in privacy. And so what we'll do is we may have one of our deacons or deaconesses read a testimony by somebody in the church who was really helped, but maybe anonymously, and say, I just really want to thank you so much for, helping out. I thought I was going to be turned out of my house. I had some bad habits. I got counseling. This and that happened, and it's really put my life together, and people prayed with me, etc. Now, when you hear a testimony read like that in a service, anonymously, number one, you're not as afraid of going to the diaconate yourself because you see that your cover won't be blown. Number two, you feel like, this church is really doing something for people. And so celebrating deeds of mercy and justice inside the service at certain spots is actually very inclusive because, again, outsiders come in and say, wow, this church is really helping people. It's not just simply in growing its own tribe. F, present the when you do baptism and you do the Lord's Supper, be very careful in doing it in a way that has evangelistic overtones. So, for example, when you do baptism, make sure you're explaining what baptism really represents to the people out there who've never been baptized. But even the Lord's Supper can seem very, very exclusive. But what we've done at Redeemer over the years is we've said something like this. We said, if you have come to the place where you see that you're ready to really receive Christ and enter into a relationship with Him, but you haven't been baptized, you haven't made a profession of faith yet, don't take the Lord's Supper. This is for people who have already made that commitment. Instead, take Christ during this Lord's Supper. Don't take the bread, don't take the cup, take Him. Give yourself to Him in a way you never have in your heart. Then come to one of the elders, come to one of the ministers, present yourself for baptism, and then later on you're going to be able to take the Lord's Supper. Now, what is that? That's a great evangelistic pitch. And by the way, I didn't come up with it. A couple of my associate pastors years ago did. And in the early days of Redeemer, when I was doing more processing of people into baptism, I can't tell you how many people said, I've been coming to Redeemer. And I guess I was thinking, am I a Christian? Maybe I am, maybe I'm not. And when we got to the Lord's Supper, and somebody fenced the table like that, not that they would use the term, fence the table, but that's an old Presbyterian term. They fenced the table like that, and I suddenly began to realize, I'm not sure where I stand. See, the Lord's Supper pushed them and made them, they were in process. But when the Lord's Supper was put in front of them and said, this is not for you unless you've made this move, they suddenly realized they hadn't made the move. See, this is a way of making sure, the Lord's Supper is for the family, right? But it's a tremendous ordinance for evangelism. And then preach grace, we've talked about that. If you preach not just biblical principles, but you're always showing people how the solution to your problem is a lack of faith in Christ, and the solution to your problem, oh Christians, is that you don't believe the gospel like you ought to, then every time you're solving a Christian's problem with the gospel, the non-Christian's hearing the gospel. How much more evangelistic and edificational could you be at one time than that? If you know how to preach Christ-centered, grace-oriented sermons, then you automatically bring them together. And then lastly, no, there's no lastly. I have to finish there. My time is running out. There's one place, and only one place, where you bring these things together instead of pitting evangelism against, you know, building people up. Now, let me give you... I think I may have to just stop there because I really want to give us time. There is a whole lot more in here, especially those of you who wonder about the justice stuff. You know, does that really fit in? And I make my case in here, but I think the best thing to do is not to try to plunge into another whole area, but let you stick with the handout and let's do what we did last time. Now, here's what I want you to do. I really only talked to you about two things. I want you to turn around and have 5 or 10 minutes in which you talk to each other and surface your questions and then ask me the questions after we're done. But I talked to you about the balance of those four ministries and how they work out. And then I went down into just showing how evangelism and discipleship can be, really be done at once in the services. I didn't get so much into how justice and evangelism work together or how faith work and discipleship work together. But if you have questions you want to surface about that, mention them and then bring them back to me, and I might be able to just take you to other parts of the handout. So right now, do what you did before. Find several other people right around you and take 5 to 7 minutes to surface the questions, and after that I'll bring you back and we'll do a Q&A. Okay? Down here at the front and then all the way in the back after that. Yes.
Tim, your thoughts on either turning the super tacker or abandoning ship, because our problem is that Agnes, who's been playing communion at 12, is now 25, has been playing every month. Our readers can't read particularly well.
Right.
Our prayers ramble. So what would you... Our choir is wedded to their robes.
Right, you shouldn't have... Yes.
So is it easier to turn the super tanker, or is it easier to abandon ship and start again somewhere else?
Well, I was going to talk about abandoning ship. For example, one of the things you could do is not have a choir and say that what we do at Redeemer is we do not have a choir. Instead, every time we want to bring people together to sing, we tell people, we reconstitute a group. It actually breaks up the little group of people that, the only ones that have time and the commitment to come. And you have some very good singers out there that don't have the time. And by basically making sure that every time we use a choir, it's a one-off. Essentially, every time we do it, it's a new entity, because we give them a 2 weeks' notice and say, come to this week, and we rehearse, and then the following week we do it. And we find that we get better people that way. We're not asking anybody for to be in the choir, because that's just too big a commitment for people. And we try not to have a choir every week, because, you know what, no matter how good they are, they'll never be good every week. They just won't be. And so that's I think, a diplomatic way of abandoning ship. There's probably ways of just breaking up the old patterns and say we're going to do it differently. The other thing that might help on the music is there are always music students or teachers around that are actually pretty good people. When it comes to when it comes to solos, you really want to have strong Christians so they're not perjuring themselves. Remember that woman I told you about in the very beginning who is a great singer, but she knew that when she was singing a Christian song in a service that it was very different. It wasn't a performance. She was testifying. And she sensed that, and that's why she was always more nervous. But I don't know. I guess I would actually go to a Christian who doesn't go to my congregation to have that person come in. There's enough of them around that you could have them come once a year or twice a year and have them come in and just really, treat them warmly. And I know you may have, the difficulty is I have people in the church who are not very good, but want to use their gifts, but they're actually not very good. And the only way you can say it is everybody else has to do. Have you ever heard of the woman who had the gift of singing, but nobody had the gift of listening to her? What you want to say is it'd be better to have Christians who are really good at this to come in and help us, even though they're not members of the church. And I had some people leave over this. I've had people unhappy because I wouldn't let them regularly come up. It didn't mean I never let them, but they wouldn't let them come up all the time. And I had some people leave because they wanted to find a church where they could use their gifts all the time. And all you can say is, I love you, hope you can stay, but it's not. It was still better for the services that we had visiting Christian artists than having our homegrown people there all the time that some people like, but most people recognize just were really, they weren't edifying. So I would say abandon ship, do new things. By the way, if you have something bigger, I have never been against, if you have, a flautist, who is not a believer, but who's been coming to Redeemer for years, and I think is slowly getting there because we've reached out to her. And we would never have her. It's not the same as singing a solo to play the flute. And to have her play the flute and accompany, a woman or a man singing, and then a piano, and to have, her name is Sato Mughalian, and she's a great flute player. You may have heard of her. She's pretty well known. Armenian, lived in New York for years. And she loves Redeemer because Redeemer's always reached out to her, and I think very slowly, sometimes now she comes with some regularity because we've reached out to her. Now some people say, you had a non-Christian flute player up there? That's not right. She's sort of up front leading worship. But see, everybody knows we're trying to reach out to her. And there's non-Christians out there, aren't there? And are we letting them sing hymns? Oh, no, you better not sing because you're not a Christian and you don't mean that. Well, see, why can't I have a couple up front? So as long as everybody knows what's going on, there's really no reason why you couldn't actually incorporate some non-Christian musicians up front, as long as they're not the main, the one singing the solo and that kind of thing. Accompanists and that kind of thing. It's actually, we found over the years a number of non-Christian musicians have come to faith in Christ. That's what I mean by saying, I'd say abandon ship, think of new ways of doing things. Yes, back there.
Tim, I think many of us have been on that first bit for some time. We're not so good at the last two bits of the balance, I think. And certainly, I've been 1 year now, where I am in North London. And I think altogether as a church, we recognize two things. One is that although we believe in justice and mercy ministries, we don't really know where to start.
Right.
I'd be interested to know where you started and how. Once you've decided, yeah, we want to do this, how do we go about it? And the second thing on the faith and work, I had all of our church council around sort of, my wife and I sort of six or eight at a time. And I asked them one question, what do you love best about St. James? And if you could click your fingers, what would you change about St. James if you could change it overnight?
Change
our church overnight.
Uh-huh.
And several of them said something along the lines, and one person particularly said it, I just wish that what I heard on Sundays connected better with what I do on Mondays. So your faith and work thing and your justice and mercy thing, okay. I think, certainly in many of our evangelical Anglican churches, though, where some of us are weaker, and I'd love some
help
and
guidance. You're right, and I should have gotten there. So I'll tell you what, let me just take you through two little paragraphs in the handout. So go to page 21, I think. This is practical issues when it comes to justice and mercy. You see where it says practical issues B? Okay, let me show you something here. I have down here six practical policy issues that immediately confront you whenever you begin to try to reach out. Now, the best way to try to reach out, actually, is to get a group of men and women, first of all, to take an offering a special offering on top of everything else. It just has to be over and above what you ordinarily give to the church. And it's, you could call it a diaconal offering. You could call it a discretionary fund. And you say, we have, and you have to let people know that there's these one or two men or women of the church who we believe will be completely discreet, that we have entrusted with this, and we want to give them the ministry of Acts chapter 6. And ministry of Acts chapter 6 was that there were people in our midst that had a need for food or had a need for finance, and we don't want to do what 1 John says, that we say to certain people, go be warm and filled. Let us not love in word only, but deed. And so you make a little case for that. And then you say, we've put aside this money, and we have some people who now are going to be keeping their ears open. And usually what happens is someone in the church, we call it rats on. Do you have that term here? Someone in the church tells the little committee, there's a struggling family here. Would you go by and see whether there's some way in which the church could help? Usually people, especially I would imagine British people, but even Americans, aren't likely to show up and say, I need money. I hear you're a church with money. That's not how it works. Usually what happens is people hear about people, and so you have to very discreetly go and offer. And that's one way to start ministry inside the church. Another way is to just hook up with something, some program where you get your people volunteering in a program that you like, probably a Christian program, but maybe not, that works with needy people in your community. Those are the two ways to do it. But as soon as you start to do this, you're going to come up against these six policy issues, and I just want you to know ahead of time what they are. First of all, level of priority. How much should we help? Justice Service Ministry is very expensive. How much of a priority should it be in relationship to your other ministries? Should a church wait until it's bigger and established before doing something in this area? The needs are endless. How do you know what percentage of the church's energy and money should go into it? There'll be debates about that unless you just start up front and say, how much of our budget, how much of our income, what are we going to do? How much are we going to give to it? So just talk about it. Don't wait for the argument to come up. Number two, how do you define a poor person? Who do we help? How needy must somebody be before we help them? How do we define need, and how are we sure we're serving only those that are really needy? See, that's another area that people argue about. I'm not giving the answers right here, but you actually can come up with some ways. If you're willing to talk about these things ahead of time, you will very often find that the ministry moves forward. But if you shouldn't wait until the arguments start, then personalities get involved. Number three, should we have conditions? That is to say, if we give people money, should we say, well, we're asking you to do this and this and this, or should it be without any strings attached? Number four, justice ministry consists of helping individuals through, at one level, mercy and justice is just helping people with money and food. At another level, it's going after unjust social systems. And what are you going to do there? In general, I say the local church, under its officers, ought to be working down here. And that when you're starting to take on justice, unjust systems, which getting into politics and legislation, that's where you, what Kuyper calls the organic church. That's where I believe Christians ought to get themselves into organizations or agencies and not have the church try to do that as the church. But I'm already showing you I'm prejudicing you. I'm already showing you one answer to question four. Question five. Should we encourage people to move into the areas where we're trying to help needy people? Or would that lead to what's called gentrification, and should we do it from more of a distance? Because that question comes up. And number six, are we paternalistically helping the poor out of pity, or are we actually finding ways to show them respect and lift them up? Now, that's more of a rhetorical question. But these areas are areas that you, if you either get involved with ministries of mercy and justice by sending people into existing programs from your church to volunteer, or by putting some money together and beginning to, in a discreet way, reach out to people in your neighborhood or right around inside your church, these are the six issues that will come up. Now, that's very, very fast. So that's something. On justice and, pardon me, on cultural renewal, It's in here, but let me just, I'm afraid I'm going to take all the time up with this. Your questions are right. At Redeemer, we do three things for faith and work ministry. One is we call vocational fellowships, and that means we simply bring people together sometimes two or three times a year, sometimes once a month, in their vocational field to get together simply to for support. We could say get together and decide what would be a good use of your time. So we get Christian lawyers together, Christian medical professionals together. We have like 12 Christian in marketing and advertising, Christians in the visual arts, Christians. I mean, the nice thing about a big church is we actually have a vocational fellowship just for composers. It's 40 people. I mean, that's the advantage of having thousands of people in Manhattan. It's really cool that there's actually a composers fellowship. So, I know. So I threw that in there. I'm not trying to make you feel bad. I mean, listen, there are many good things as bad things about being a big church, and there's many good things and bad things about being a small church. I've been both places. I really don't see one as being better than the other, in spite of the fact that our self-justified little hearts want to hate one or the other. But the fact is, anyway, but that one of the advantages is vocational. So you get them together vocationally. The second thing we do is Gotham Fellows right now, which is a discipleship program for young people after university, in which we give the young people a mentor in their field, and we give them a lot of theological and worldview kinds of study, and we're trying to create discipleship for people who are going to be more well-trained to be Christians in their jobs. It's not the typical discipleship, which is more about how you can lead Bible studies and eventually go into the ministry. It's how to be a good lawyer and so on. So what we do is we have 25 in our inaugural program. Each of them has a mentor in their field. It's tremendous. And the third thing is something that probably shouldn't be in the church after a while, and that's called the Entrepreneurship Forum. And that is a couple of wealthy people in the church put money into a pot. And then we have a business plan competition. And we award people who want to start a business or start a nonprofit and show how the gospel has shaped their business plan, get a grant every year to go into business for themselves. That is probably what I would call church organic, not church institutional church. At some point, somebody's going to complain about that and is going to say, hey, why did that person win the business model, the plan instead of that? And the elders are going to say, we're really not in a position to judge these sorts of things. That ought to be spun out and be something else. But those are the three things we do right now: the Entrepreneurship Forum, the Gotham Fellows, and vocational fellowships. Okay. I'm sorry it took so much of your precious time, but basically his questions were, why didn't you finish the handout? And that's fair. Okay. Somebody else? Yes, right here.
Yes, when you head out of the church to do some sort of justice and mercy ministry, I guess you're going to encounter other Christians in one form or another, possibly from the mainline churches. So how do you navigate that sort of questions that's going to come before you? Do you join in with them and just ask no questions, or
Do you join in with the people you're trying to help, or people?
No, this is other Christians of all kinds of different varieties.
Right. that if your church is... again, that's one of the advantages of a larger church, is that you have such a large volunteer force. But when the church was smaller, we had that issue. And by and large, most of the time, what we said to our folks, work hand in glove with the people, get to see how Christians have fairly different beliefs. Be gracious when you find that they assume that you believe this when you don't. So, actually, we're Presbyterian evangelicals. So the two other kinds of Christians that really seem very different. When our volunteers from our church and our converts went out into the city to work with the poor, they were with mainline liberal Christians and charismatic Pentecostal Christians. And both of those groups are really different than evangelical Presbyterians. And some of our folks came back from some of the, rehabbing a house, in Harlem, helping a poor person get into a house. working with mainline people or Pentecostal people. Some of our, especially our newer converts, came back kind of shell-shocked and realizing these other Christians really think very differently. And it's a, some, therefore, you might, with your sort of baby believers, your newer Christians who have been nurtured in your church and they only see your kind of Christianity, if they move out there and they start working with folks that are that different, some of them might need, how do I say it, support services from you. You need to debrief them a little bit. Come back and say, well, what did you notice? And they'll say, well, they said this and this. And so you're probably right in saying that that's a concern. And I think that if you do help people in your church go out, you might want to really closely monitor how they're processing what they're hearing. But in the end, I would say it'd be better to cooperate with other Christians than say we have to do it ourselves. That's part of
basically what, you wouldn't draw too strong theological lines.
Not real strong. Not for helping the poor. I wouldn't. You know, and when it comes to trying to do evangelism or something like that, you know, to do a joint evangelistic effort, that's very different because the message is, we so disagree on what the message would be. So yes, in general, I would say be cooperative, but be careful with your people. Make sure that you're supporting them because they really can be. I mean, this might sound a little bit overdrawn, but the mainline Christians were more liberal than what our folks were trained to be, and a lot of the Pentecostals were more conservative, and it seemed more legalistic to our people, and we had to very often talk to them about why are other churches like this and why are they different and how do we differ. So you do have to be aware of that, but in general I would do cooperation by and large, not always.
Yeah.
Okay. How about back here, Sunil, and then over here? We have time for two, I think.
Just picking up, Tim, on your comments about excellence in worship being inclusive. We had a conversation in our group about how it can, particularly in a smaller church, how it can actually be quite intimidating if somebody is, say, very gifted in music and can actually, I think we had an example where it happened and people were sort of almost shocked and overawed. And it was very. And one of the things we said was perhaps pre-planning would help in terms of preempting that and thinking how, as a leadership team, would we handle that. Do you have any other comments to make on that?
So you're saying that blindingly brilliant artists may seem actually out of place in a small working class. Yeah, I agree. I'm just talking about making it really pretty, really good. Actually, Redeemer, when the church was smaller, didn't have the kind of some of the spectacular artists that we have now, and it would have felt too overwhelming when a church is smaller. I think that I would simply say this: it needs to be good quality. It does need to be appropriate to your size and to your people. There's a danger with some of the really best, really, really good artists very often cannot go out of performance mode. I was actually so happy when this young woman told me she was nervous because she knew it wasn't a performance. You see, you know, so many artists, even Christian artists, just do not know about that. They are exactly the same in a church service as they are on a stage for the concert. And so I do want to parse these differences. I do say, get someone who's good and who can move you, but maybe not some world-class person because it would seem to be too blinding or kind of overwhelming. And besides that, very often the world-class people need to be trained that this is worship. This is, you're testifying, you're not performing. Whereas sometimes the more middle-of-the-road good people, you know, the local music teacher at the local school will be perfectly good but won't be a marquee name. And those people would be more appropriate. They're also closer to you. They're in the community. So that's a very good qualification, and it's a very important thing to remember. So, over here, yeah. Music.
I was wondering how you allow your services to be accessible for constant newcomers, and yet allow the believers to deepen their understanding of Scripture. Is it during the week that you allow other venues? Or?
I refer to that a little bit in the handout, places I didn't go. There's one of the things that I have to avoid if I want to include Christians and non-Christians. I do avoid areas that people probably need to be instructed in that maybe in some churches you would go to, but I wouldn't go to. For example, I'm not going to ordinarily do teaching on the different views of baptism. You know, for example, I'm a Presbyterian, and we baptize infants. Why? You know, why don't other people baptize infants? I think that's an extremely important. In other words, you could preach a good biblical exposition on two or three passages about baptism, show why the different Christians differ. You can be very gracious. You can still make your case for why we do it the way we do. I think there was a day in which when I was in Virginia, I did preach like that because I really expected everybody to be there would be our people, and I'm just instructing them on our doctrinal distinctives. I don't do that now because it's actually, I would say that's level D, and I'm basically staying on level A, B, and C. Now, to stay on level A, B, and C in doctrine still means I'm talking about propitiation and heaven and hell and you know, substitutionary atonement and forensic justification and sanctification. I'm talking about all the meaty doctrines, but I'm not going to places where it's ethical and doctrinal distinctives that my people ought to know, but I don't feel like I can do in a way in a worship service that necessarily adores Christ and unites believers and unbelievers. So I actually have offloaded, we could say, a fair amount of instruction to small groups and classes that I used to try to get into my worship services. And I would say that I think that in the long run, I'll just be honest with you, I think it's been good. I feel like if you try to load a lot of instruction into that Sunday gathering because it seems like a good use of time, they're all there. You know, as soon as you try to have a class, you know, only like 10% of them show up. Okay, so if so there's a tendency to say, I got them all here, so I'm going to hit them with everything I want them to know. And I think that what that can do is that can turn your worship gathering from a transcendent service of worship into a kind of a Sunday school class. So I actually would say you're going to have to, if you do the way I'm suggesting, some of the things the more instructional things that you would tend to put into a Sunday gathering, you find other places to do it. You create classes. You do a retreat. That's one way to get a lot of people out. Do a couple of retreats and go down on certain areas that you feel like I no longer now feel like I should be putting into my Sunday exposition. So the deeper teaching has to be there. You have to find a way of getting it in. But I don't think it's a good idea to try to load it all on Sunday. So I used to, but I don't anymore. But now, time is up, right? We have time for the next thing, whatever that is.